I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is Paul Kersey, who is the author of a number of books, including one of his most recent books I've just read. It's called Whitey on the Moon. He's also the blogger at Stuff Black People Don't Like. We're going to talk about the movie Hidden Figures and what it means. So, Paul, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm looking forward to continuing a conversation that we started on The Right Stuff, which I think was fantastic. Those guys are just absolutely great in all that they're doing. And I just wanted to get the opportunity to talk with you because you published a fantastic article, review of the movie. And I think that this is probably going to win Best Picture this coming Sunday at the Academy Awards. And as your listeners are going to hear in our conversation, this is probably the first of many of these type of revisionist films. If you look at the Google doodles that come out routinely that highlight some seemingly insignificant achievements of a black individual, black male, black female, and then hype it to be some innovation that without their genius, then we wouldn't be where we are today. I think that that portends the future of cinema and the retconning of history.
I agree. And you've done a lot of really good coverage of this movie as well. And there's just so much more to say that after we did the Daily Show, we thought, well, we just need to continue the conversation, especially once it became apparent that this was going to be a shoe-in for Best Picture. I pray that it will not get Best Picture, but the signaling spiral has not died down yet, and it might sweep its way into a Best Picture award, which would be truly a black mark on Hollywood, even though most of us know that the Academy Awards is pretty much political and always has been.
Well, I mean, look at it this way. Look at what just happened at the Grammys last week when people said the Grammys so white when Adele won for Best Artist of the Year, Best Album, and Beyonce, who's won 22 Grammys. Somehow they tried to make the claim and start some conversation that the Grammys are racist. There couldn't be a less racist endeavor than the Grammys in pop culture music.
Right, exactly. It's like saying the NFL is racist. Of course, we know how racist it is, but it's not racist against black people. And the two areas where black people can genuinely become famous and achieve quite a lot, especially if you sort of change the rules a bit to favor them, are professional sports, especially things like football and basketball, and of course, singing and dancing, pop music kind of stuff. And so the idea that this is stacked against blacks is ludicrous. It's stacked for blacks, obviously.
And the same thing goes for cinema. Was it 2002 when Training Day came out and Denzel? That was the year that everyone made a big deal because I believe Halle Berry and Denzel Washington both won Best Actors, Best Actress. First time that's ever happened. Two African American. Although Halle Berry, you know, she's a mulatto. Her mother's white, and if you look at her kids, she had with the two French guys. I mean, gosh, they're even whiter than Katherine Johnson was in real life. My point is that this started a couple years ago when someone tweeted out Oscars so white, and then our friends in the journalist industry decided to, hey, we've got ourselves something to get behind and advocate for, and we can attack the Academy. I think at the time that they started attacking the Academy in 2015, it turns out that the Academy voters are, I think, like 93% white. Of course, no one ever asks what percent Jewish the Academy is. That's, I guess, off limits.
Right.
But the point is that we've got to get as many voices of diversity in there as possible so that we can have a legitimate Academy Awards.
Right.
It, of course, got even worse in 2016. I can't remember what magazine it was. It was Vogue or Vanity Fair, where they had a cover story of all the actresses and who were up for Best Actress and Best Supporting Actress. And I want to say that they were all white. And you almost look at that and you wonder, well, I wonder if they actually did this as part of an agenda to really push for this Oscar so white. Because after last year, that's when the pressure became too great. And, you know, Hollywood Reporter, everyone was talking about this as if this was the next great crusade, the next civil rights struggle. And that's why it's so fascinating to think of how, you know, there are currently three films in production on Emmett Till and this Hidden Figures movie, even before the manuscript of, I'm sorry, before the book was done that it's based on, was finished. They had bought the rights to it and they greenlit a movie, even though the book wasn't done yet. So the scriptwriters were able to go in and manufacture a lot of the so-called white bigoted, white racial characters who basically try and inhibit Katherine Johnson. But my point is that, you know, they realized whatever studio bought this picture, like, we've got to greenlight this because this is an opportunity here for to make right with the current zeitgeist. And as is it all right if I say your review? Is it known that Trevor Lynch is you? Or
oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm Trevor Lynch.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you've done some fantastic reviews. Your reviews of the Dark Knight trilogy. Nolan's work was just spot on. When you think about Nolan, you know, he made that phenomenal film, Interstellar. And I remember when I saw the initial trailer for that, it's got, gosh, what is his name? Why can't I think right now?
Matthew McConaughey.
It's got Matthew McConaughey, and he's doing that voiceover about how we used to be pioneers. We used to strive for greatness. And it's got that really powerful Hans Zimmer score. And, you know, Matthew McConaughey's character is talking about, you know, what is it going to be that we're going to unite to strive for, to struggle? We have to get back to that or else we're going to perish. And I remember when I saw that, I'm like, you know what? Why did we stop reaching for the stars? And that's when I got really interested in NASA. This was 2013. I've always been interested in reading about the Mercury and Apollo missions and von Braun and what went on at the Huntsville and Cape Canaveral. But, you know, it's when I discovered this, guy's thesis. It was just fascinating, Greg. It's a guy named Mark Thompson wrote Space Race, African American Newspapers Respond to Sputnik and Apollo 11. It's this thesis that he prepared for his degree, Master of Arts at the University of North Texas. And he put the entire thing online. It's brilliant because all he does is he read all the black press. And, you know, for millennial listeners, and I'm a millennial, you know, you have to remember that before the internet in every major city where there was the African diaspora from the Great Migration, you had black press, black newspapers. You know, the Defender in Chicago, there's a paper in Los Angeles, pretty famous paper in New York, I think it was called the Amsterdam, papers in Washington, D.C., papers in Baltimore. And this was, you know, in the era of segregation, and Greg, I think you'd agree with me, this is a positive thing because these newspapers catered to the black community and they advocated on behalf of the black community. I can't fault them for that.
No, not at all.
They would talk about the news of the day. They talk about high society, and they would also talk about political policy. And what's so fascinating about the whole Hidden Figures movie, and we're going to get into this, the movie aspect in a few seconds, but when you actually look at what the black community was saying in the 1960s about this massive investment in the space program and how misguided it was that we were spending billions of dollars. I mean, think about what happened in 1964, 1965, the Civil Rights Acts, and 1968, the Fair Housing. And yet, at the same time, you know, remember, in the 1960s, white America was 90% white and 10% black. We hadn't had the floodgates open for the Third World. And, you know, our borders, basically, the idea of sovereignty was still intact. So illegal immigration really wasn't a problem, at least in the numbers we have now. So the black press was agitating for the redistribution of white tax dollars to go to their community for housing, for welfare, for food, for jobs programs. And yet, at the same time, you've got literally one of the most incredible endeavors that a state has ever embarked upon. And that is, of course, John F. Kennedy's promise that by the end of the decade, we would get to the moon. And to think that we were able to do that in 8 years, when the first flight that in recorded history, the Wright brothers down there in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina in 1903, to think that we were able to get to the moon by 1969, it really blows your mind to think that in 66 years, we went from flying on a beach to landing on the moon, one small step for a man. And then at the same time, though, the big debate going on, which is just fascinating when you actually look at it, because the people who were making the arguments that we should abandon space adventures for trying to prove that race is a social construct and that all we have to do is throw vast amounts, trillions of dollars at that community to make everyone live a Norman Rockwell, regardless of color, style life. That's what we actually decided to do post-1972 when the Apollo program ended. And we're going to get to that aspect because I think that's the most interesting aspect of the whole Hidden Figures concept, because as your review pointed out, Greg, you noted that everything that was going on in this movie that is glorified happened in an era when Jim Crow still existed, when civil rights hadn't even been enacted yet to allow someone like Katherine Johnson, who was a legitimate mathematician. She co-authored a paper that was published in 1960 about trajectories for satellites. She wrote with a white guy. But she was hired, I believe your review points out, in 1953, or was it 57?
I think it was 53.
Yeah, she was hired by the precursor to NASA. I think it was NACA. I don't remember what that acronym stands for. But yeah, this was an era when affirmative action was unheard of. She was hired based upon her merit. She went to a historically black college. She came from a well-to-do family, where she was a math prodigy at a young age, and she graduated high school early. She started college, and you know, as your review notes, the movie is basically, in a lot of ways, a love story. That's what the whole book is about. It's about her courtship with her husband, and kind of the book has almost nothing to do with mathematics. When I finished the book, I remember thinking to myself, what did this woman actually do? This is not even a part of the book, really. That's
fascinating. I haven't
secondary.
Read the book yet. Yeah, the thing about this movie is that it is set before the civil rights era, and it shows blacks with intact families. Katherine Johnson is a widow, and then she marries her second husband in the movie. All the other black female characters have husbands. They're all well-dressed. They're very polite. They seem to have strong communal bonds. Their churches are a big thing. It's kind of idyllic, and it's very easy to think, well, what a terrible injustice to hold these people back, right? They're so much like us. Well, the truth is that the reason they were so much like us was precisely because of the pressures put upon them to conform to white social norms by the hated white supremacy system. And as soon as civil rights came through, and as soon as Americans just started feeling terribly guilty about imposing their standards of behavior and culture on black people, well, we see what happened. The black community went to hell. Today, we have white liberals who coo over this movie and love it and think it's so wonderful. They're cooing over a time before civil rights, and they are terrified of blacks today, especially the black thugs, large numbers of which exist now. Why? Well, because civil rights made them that way. Civil rights gave them the freedom to decline into what blacks are today. And so it's a weird thing. There are lots of blacks who are watching this movie and they love it and they feel nostalgic toward it. They're feeling nostalgia towards the time of segregation and white supremacy. It's a very odd, paradoxical, self-subverting trait of this movie. It actually subverts its message. In terms of the three women who are portrayed in their careers at NASA, again, all of these women existed before affirmative action, before civil rights, and yet, because they had talent and a bit of pluck, right, they were willing to go the extra mile, they had their talents recognized and were advanced, even though there was a strong and well-founded prejudice against blacks in America. And that's the thing we have to understand. The prejudices against blacks were strong and well-founded. And when you look at the disaster of desegregation, the disasters of civil rights, the massive loss of value of properties as white neighborhoods were integrated, then destroyed, the loss of life to crime, it's been a catastrophe that we have never really calculated, but it's worse than war, right? Detroit was not atomic bombed like Hiroshima was and Nagasaki. It was not firebombed like Dresden. And yet Dresden and Hiroshima and Nagasaki have recovered from that, whereas Detroit and Camden, New Jersey, and many other cities have not recovered from civil rights and having a black majority and having a black government. Those places have been destroyed. So It's a paradoxical situation. This movie creates a longing for a period that we are supposed to be well rid of. And during this period, the talents of the women that are portrayed were not being held back, even though there were strong and well-founded prejudices against blacks. People were still willing to say, okay, well, we don't want them living with us. We don't want their standards imposed upon us, but we're in a race. We're in a Cold War. We're going to mobilize real talent, but we're going to make them jump through a few extra hoops, and they're shown jumping through a few extra hoops to prove themselves. Why? Well, they didn't have the privilege of being white, okay? And this white privilege concept is pretty bogus. What really was going on is they had to show that they didn't have the disadvantages that attended to most blacks, which were, again, based on experience, not having initiative, not being good workers, not, you know, being real, right? A lot of the problems with blacks is that they're good at mimicry and fakery, right? And sometimes you get fooled, and so you want to put them through a few extra tests to make sure that they're not just talented mimics, that they actually can do the job, and so on and so forth. The situation that these women are portrayed in is not such a bad thing. If you're going to have a multiracial society with large numbers of blacks, it was about the most humane way of dealing with it. And, of course, it's been undone now because of civil rights and quote-unquote progress to the great detriment of both whites and blacks in America.
What's fascinating about what you just said about the hoops that they had to run through, That was all part of the script. Katherine Johnson has been quoted many times as talking about how she was treated with the utmost dignity and respect. The script writers added all of those aspects into the film.
That's hilarious. So it's fictional, but it still actually is defensible as social norms in the time. That's interesting. I didn't even know that. I know that the stuff about segregated washrooms and stuff like that was supposedly bogus.
Yeah, well, there's a great site that did an analysis on the film. I wrote with this at VDare, and it's a site called History vs. Hollywood. And they went in and they looked at the questions of, hey, did the employees, the white employees at NASA, really think Katherine Johnson was a janitor and that she was there to empty the garbage can? And the people who run the site found out that the answer is no. It's an element of fiction created by the filmmakers to create, you know, the systemic racism, this implicit racism, white supremacy society. That how could you even imagine a black individual? Even though, again, when you see pictures of Katherine Johnson, and I found a bunch of them from the 1960s and late 1950s, and you look at her, you're like, what? This is a black woman? What are you talking about? There's a pretty famous picture of her in 2015 when she got the president some award from Obama, when the real push to canonize her began, almost to the point of sainthood. And she's at an event outside, and she looks like a white woman. I mean, I'm not making this up.
I've seen the pictures, and I'll put those in the show notes for people. Yeah. The woman could pass as white, and that's another thing that I think really has to be emphasized here. A lot of bona fide black achievers have significant white ancestry, and of course our recent quote-unquote black president, Obama, who's half white, perhaps even more than half white, because his father's side is from East Africa, and there's a bit of admixture basically from the Arab world in a lot of East Africans. You know, he might be more than half non-black. And it is just the case that a lot of black achievers have significant white ancestry. One of the things that we don't have to apologize for at all is the fact that in white societies, blacks can achieve things that they cannot achieve when they're left to their own devices in all black societies.
Correct.
In our society, we can put black people to work conquering the moon. Left to their own devices, they never invented the wheel. Now, I would prefer to live in a society where we forego black work and so forth. I'd prefer to live in a society where we forego taking out black and partially black outliers and integrating them into our activities and let them be authentic, let them be themselves in their own societies. Whites can do without the Katherine Johnsons of the world, and we can achieve our dreams, right? We have created first world societies wherever we go. Some of those first world societies had non-whites in them, primarily as laborers, and others didn't. And yet the societies are pretty much the same. Sweden didn't have black slaves in it, but it's an advanced first world society. Norway didn't have black slaves. It's an advanced first world society. The United States is an advanced first world society. And the reason why it's pretty much the same as Scandinavia is that the essential nature of our society is imposed upon it by white people, whether or not blacks actually played a role or not. And the role that most blacks played in our society, I hate to say, was pretty much the same role that horses and donkeys played. They were dray animals. They were farm equipment, right? They were not here to give us the benefit of their genius. And even in the cases with somebody like Katherine Johnson, the fact that she did make contributions to the space program doesn't change the essentially white nature of the society or the space program.
And that's indisputable fact when you look at the mechanical cotton picker that was invented, I believe, in the 19 during the Great War, I think 1915, 1917, which basically made black labor as sharecroppers in the South obsolete, which regrettably led to perhaps the most disastrous migration in human history, the Great Migration, where blacks flooded into Chicago, flooded into Detroit, went to Los Angeles, San Francisco, Baltimore, New York, Buffalo, Rochester, and Gary, Indiana, Indianapolis. All these places that previously had Cleveland, Ohio, that previously had been allowed to evolve unmolested from the African genome. And once you introduce that, large portions of those previously all-white communities, where they had been a true melting pot of Europeans, whether it was Western, Southern, largely in those communities, there were largely Jewish populations as well. But my point is that the invention of the mechanical cotton picker made black labor obsolete. And as we continue to see with the disparity in wealth and income and achievement and education, the labor is still virtually obsolete, and increasingly so in a society dominated by STEM jobs. I want to get back real quickly because it's important to, and we were talking about Hidden Figures, Greg, that the characters of these white characters who stopped Katherine Johnson in every way. I'm talking about the character, the actor from The Big Bang Theory, Jim Parsons and Kirsten Dunst, both of those characters were made up in this film. They didn't exist. Mm-hmm. Jim Parsons played a guy named Paul Stafford, who apparently he was created, according to History versus Hollywood. He was specifically created, and I quote, to represent certain racist and sexist attitudes that existed in the 1950s. And in the film, he thwarts Katherine Johnson's character, played by Taraji P. Henson, every way. Basically, you know, reducing her to job qualifications, to secretarial duty, omitting her byline official reports. And I think he even demeaned her by saying it wasn't appropriate that women attend space program briefings. And all of this was done for a story arc of basically creating this character, this white character who at first refuses to acknowledge why she's there. And then at the end understands that, wow, you really are this genius. When in fact, there was no one like that. Katherine Johnson's name appears on a couple of papers that were published out of Langley, Virginia, mm-hmm. at the Space Center. She did make some contributions. Now, we don't know how many because there were a lot of people working on these reports,
right.
Which I'll get to in a second. Kirsten Dunst's character, she was a supervisor, I guess, in the film. And again, she was created to represent some of the unconscious bias and prejudice of the era, unquote. That's what that History versus Hollywood says. Mm-hmm. Again, pure fiction to satisfy the political proclivities and tastes of white liberals today.
Right.
They have to have characters that fit their narrow worldview back in those days so that they can have commonality to reinforce their prejudices.
Right, exactly. And the common denominator of all these fictions is the era of Jim Crow was defined by people who were insecure and petty and inflicted petty indignities upon black people, like treating them as domestic servants or janitors, or forcing them to run to half a mile to go to the bathroom. And they were afraid of these people's competition and so forth. And apparently that just wasn't true. That just didn't happen in these particular cases. But even if these sorts of things did happen, even if, for instance, Kirsten Dunst's character did exist and was somewhat skeptical about promoting a black woman to a supervisory position, it seems perfectly reasonable to me that she would be somewhat skeptical and make her go through a couple extra hoops. But when she proved herself, yeah, she got promoted. What was so wrong about that? I come back to that. What was so wrong about this? What was so horrible about this segregated society if it didn't really stand in the way of outliers in the black community actually accomplishing things and making a positive contribution to some great endeavor like the space race? It doesn't seem like it was such a bad society, especially when you look at how healthy the community was and the families were and how decorous people were. The romance between Katherine Johnson and her husband seems like something out of a Jane Austen novel. There's no twerking and medicking, right, in their courtship. Everything has gone to hell with blacks since then. And this movie actually promotes nostalgia for segregation against its own intent. But it actually does that, and it's an interesting thing to contemplate.
Two thoughts on that. One, I believe the Moynihan report from the congressman from, the senator.
New York.
Did that come out in the late 60s or early 70s?
It was around the turn of the decades. I don't remember exactly when.
It's important to note that even though we're waxing nostalgically for Jim Crow segregation before civil rights was passed, that even then the black illegitimacy rate was, 29%? I think it was around almost 30%. Mm-hmm. So even under then, when when Jim Crow acted as a check against black dysfunction, it still wasn't working that well.
Yeah, exactly.
It really wasn't. I mean, you have to remember some of the horrifying crime rates that we were seeing in Chicago. I mean, again, there's a reason why you had restricted covenants.
Right.
I just read a fascinating article in one of the St. Louis papers. They were glorifying the Shelley House of Shelley versus Kramer in 1948, which struck down restrictive covenants, the ability for an individual to basically have freedom of association. To, if they have a piece of property, to real quick, what restrictive covenants are? It allows when someone sells a house, they're allowed to put a restrictive covenant on it that would dictate that that house cannot be sold to a individual that is black, or you could even say at this point, if they still existed, you cannot sell this to a renter who will then turn it into a flop house for 10 illegal immigrant families. I mean, these were, if you want to talk about the Constitution and what it means to actually have liberty, the very first concept should be freedom of association, the ability to discriminate. And if you don't have that, you don't have any freedom.
Right.
And the other point that I really wanted to make, with Hidden Figures, it's vital that we understand the concept of taxpayer dollars. Back before we had, we were just basically living in an era when the Federal Reserve could print money and have budgets that continued to get larger and larger instead of a debt ceiling and whatnot. NASA had to account for every penny that was spent because you had liberals who were very adamant in their opposition to NASA, because they did want to spend money to help out the poor who were hungry, to help out blacks. And they were wondering why are we going on these ridiculous endeavors into space? And the book From the Earth to the Moon, which turned out to be probably the greatest thing HBO will ever produce. It was a Tom Hanks inspired documentary. They shot it with some of the great character actors. Bryan Cranston's in it. I'm trying to think of some other actors that are in it. It's this brilliant cast, and it's basically about the Mercury Apollo program. And the very first episode in the special, which is so worth getting on Amazon, it's about Apollo 1 when Gus Grissom, when they had that tragedy, when the three astronauts of the Apollo 1 mission. They died during a testing phase. And the whole first episode is about how NASA had to show that every penny they were spending wasn't wasting taxpayer dollars. They had to go to Washington, go through all these hearings to show that, no, of course we're not wasting taxpayer dollars. And who was the guy who was – Walter Mondale is a congressman from Minnesota in the first episode. And he's raving on and on and on during this hearing about how this is just such a monumental flushing of taxpayer dollars. And going back to your point about Katherine Johnson being promoted, you couldn't help but promote the best people to ensure that you got the best results, Greg.
Right.
You couldn't have someone who was going to drag your team down and then jeopardize the ability to the next year when it came around to budgeting for the amount of money that was going to be allocated to your department for R&D for whatever. You had to be able to substantiate everything that you were doing. And one team member that lacked the dexterity to evolve to conform to the mission, that could screw up your funding. And what's so vital about this whole Hidden Figures, and this is, I think, the most important idea about this movie, that when you see the marketing for this, now remember, it was a $25 million production budget, and they spent more than that on marketing this movie. And when you see the images of the posters, and when you see the trailer, you get the impression that this woman, Katherine Johnson, was the pivotal person to get man into space. You don't really know what she did, but the marketing makes you feel like she is the individual who got us into space and beat the Russians or whatever it is that she did.
If not for her, man would not have walked on the moon.
That's what the marketing makes you feel. And it's important that I quote the author of the book, Margaret Shetterly, who said this to space.com. Quote, "You might get the indication in the movie that these were the only people doing those jobs, when in reality we know they worked in teams, and those teams had other teams. There were sections, branches, divisions, and they all went up to a director. There were so many people required to make this happen, but I understand you can't make a movie with 300 characters. It is simply not possible." End quote.
Yeah, exactly. They were part of large teams. They were cogs in a great machine. And that means that they were essentially fungible for the most part and dispensable. One thing that cracked me up is about a week ago, I was taking a trip and there were some people talking about Hidden Figures. Some blacks were talking about Hidden Figures. And this black man says, "She was a human computer." And I just wanted to die. I was cringing because, of course, everyone in those offices was called a computer. There was a time when you wouldn't say somebody is a human computer. You'd just say they were a computer, because a computer was somebody who did sums, right? Who did calculations. And when they introduced the IBM, it was actually called an electronic computer, to distinguish it from the humans who did those numbers. And now, though, the phrase human computer it sounds to people like, oh my God, she was a true prodigy. She was like smart as a machine, right? When in the context, they were all computers because they did sums on paper. And then there was the electronic computer that came in that basically put them out of work because it was so much better at it. And then to say today that somebody's a human computer makes them sound like an AI or something, like a genius beyond even the electronic computer, which actually replaced the human computer and made that phrase obsolete.
That's correct. And it's funny that you mentioned that aspect, because someone who read the initial article that I did for VDare, they sent me this guy's name. He said, just look up Jack Crenshaw. They said, look, I work in NASA. I'm sending this from an email, and there are people who work in NASA who are really upset about this film, because there's this guy named Jack Crenshaw who basically was the individual who designed the figure eight trajectory, which became known as the free return trajectory, which is, if you actually look at what it's claimed that Katherine Johnson did, I mean, again, it's it's up in the air to see what she actually did, because there's a number of different articles about her where it talks about what she worked on. And even those articles published at like Popular Science or Wired or the Smithsonian Magazine, they're very vague and to what she did, because they try and make it seem like she was the only person working on that assignment. And if you know anything about NASA, you're talking about a massive state endeavor where there were 400,000 people employed, contractors. You know, the concept of redundancy, you had people checking everything. Even you had teams of people checking the IBM computers for the data computations that were outputted to just make sure everything was fixed, because any death that happened, I mean, after Apollo 1, when Gus Grissom and the other two astronauts died on the ground during the test, they were ready to pull the funding then. So any death that would have happened had John Glenn or Alan Shepard or Jim Lovell, who was then the Cap, who was played by Tom Hanks in Apollo 13. He was, I think he was the commander of Apollo 10, which did this, which actually went around the moon. And they did that famous, I think it was 1968 or 1967, where they read from the Bible. Had there been an accident, NASA could have been done, because, again, this was a very costly, it was a different country then. We weren't able to print vast sums of money. We were about to embark on a devastating war, the Vietnam War. And, you know, we had basically, after 1965, when the Hart-Celler Immigration Act, we basically gave away our country. All these amazing things were going on at the same point, and yet still the last heroic endeavor, the last heroic act of the historic American majority, the founding population, the people who conquered this vast wilderness that Madison Grant so worried was passing away, the last act collectively of these individuals was to land a man on the moon with basically technology. Yeah, you had some computers, but yeah, you still had slide rules. You still had a bunch of guys with slide rules. and that's really cool to think about at a time when, you know, a movie like Hidden Figures comes along, and I mean, my gosh, I'm looking at Box Office Mojo, and here we are a few days away from the Academy Awards, and this is poised to replace, you know, The Right Stuff, the movie that was based on Tom Wolfe's novel, or historical novel. This is poised to replace Apollo 13. This is poised to replace all the wonderful documentaries that were made on the Apollo missions. This is poised to replace movies like October Sky. This is poised to become the new, at a time when we have to have the Russians send our astronauts up because we don't even have a space program anymore,
right?
Really.
Yeah.
We're supposed to believe this is the new foundational myth of NASA. I mean, Box Office Mojo, this movie has, I mean, it's almost like the concept of don't be the first one to stop clapping back in communist Russia,
right?
Soviet Union.
It's made $165 million in the box office so far, and it cost $25 million to make. They spent another $25 million on publicity. So this has made, let's say, $100 million.
It's a huge hit. It's a huge hit. It's got a fresh rating of 92% on Rotten Tomatoes.
94% based on the audience reactions, right? 94% of people who see this movie like it. And, you know, here's one thing that really gravels me, though. You'd think that with all this buttering up of blacks, we was astronauts as well as Kangs, right? We was the ones who invented philosophy. It doesn't actually make them interested in learning about philosophy, learning about history, or going into space. That's the thing that's so amazing about it. You'd think that if you tell these myths, if you tell these lies to blacks, that will actually make them want to become mathematicians and astronauts, and it generally doesn't work that way. It generally just increases their resentment against white people for holding them back, rather than actually encourages them to do stuff. And really, it's stuff that they're not very often cut out to do anyway, and they actually know their limits, right? And yet they feel resentment. They feel like stuff has been taken away from them. Well, if Katherine Johnson got manned to the moon, Whitey's really doubled down since then, because I'm still living in a rat-infested apartment.
It's fascinating to look at the numbers that Hidden Figures has brought in, because most films at this point rely so heavily upon the foreign market to bring in if not the majority, a close to majority of the actual box office receipts. Look at Great Wall. It bombed in America this past weekend. It just did $120, $130, $150 million in China. So it's gonna actually make money because of the international marketplace. A movie like Troy, which I really like that movie, came out in 2004. It didn't do that well in America, but it did phenomenal overseas. And who was that? Wolfgang Peterson's movie? Is that
Wolfgang Peterson? Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic film, and it did really well overseas. So you're able to survive if you can make big money overseas, because then, you know, with distribution costs and with all the different contracts for who's doing the distribution and whatnot, you're able then to actually make a profit, pay your investors back, because you have so many different production companies now making these films to put up the budgets. With Hidden Figures, it made $21 million of its $165 million in the foreign market. So it just shows you that there is – I mean – it's not cut, because I've seen reports that up to 70% of the audience who've seen this film are non-white, and it's primarily blacks who have gone to see this film. And a lot of the articles that I read a great one in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the Baltimore Sun, Washington Post. It's largely black women who keep going back to see this film because they feel empowered by it, which
right.
I don't get it. As if by osmosis they're going to start being able to do, you know, basic geometry, algebra, Pythagorean theory, and then they'll move on to calculus or trig. I guess that's what they're thinking, because it's the articles that you're reading are laughable, the headlines and whatnot. And what's really stunning is the amount of free screenings that you're seeing nationwide. A couple years ago when Selma came out, there were a number of people who put up significant amounts of money, like $500 to $1 million, to give free tickets out to minority students to go see Selma. And the same thing is happening now, where there were a lot of free screenings in major metropolitan areas over during Black History Month to try and get people to go out and see it. So, you know, who knows the amount? You'd have to quantify that to figure out how many free showings have been given out and whoever paid for it.
Right. Well, people pay for these things. They're not done for free. And also, they're taking school children to see this. Now, I guarantee they're getting paid for tickets to fill those seats with school kids. It's being paid for by tax dollars. So how much of this $165 million, or the $144 million domestic box office, is basically subsidies that are being channeled into this film? I think a significant amount, because this is a massive propaganda project. Let's be honest. It's a massive propaganda project. And even if it didn't make money, they're going to make films like this. But they want to make these things pay. They want to get people into the seats with subsidies if necessary, but definitely it's going to pay. In terms of the quality of the film, it's a really flabby film. It moves slowly. It really plays like a made-for-cable TV kind of thing, where it's sentimental, it's got lots of montages, it's really light on the science and math, there's lots of romance stuff. It's very soap opera-like, which I guess explains why women like it. You know, there's all kinds of romance angles and, you know, girls being sassy and having fun together and stuff like that. It's definitely a chick flick, and it's definitely soap opera-paced and, you know, very, very sentimental. It's just not a really good movie, even as propaganda movies go. Let's face it, it's just not a solid movie. And honestly, I think that they might give it Best Picture just because they're in a fit of signaling, but someday I hope these people will wake up and ask themselves, my God, what have we done giving a Best Picture to this total turkey? It's a real turkey of a film. It's probably one of the worst films that I've had to sit through for a long time, and it's not just because it's horrible, it's just because it's mediocre. It's just bland and mediocre for the most part.
It's a science fiction film.
Yeah.
There's a really fascinating, if you can get your hands on it, not to be confused with the Brad Bird 2015 Tomorrowland movie that George Clooney starred in, but there's a documentary that came out in the mid-2000s about the 1950s television series called Tomorrowland, which Disney produced on ABC. ABC was the last place channel at the time, and they needed cheap programming. Walt Disney was smart enough to buy up some programming to start broadcasting basically infomercials for his Walt Disney theme parks. Well, they decided to do some science factual documentaries starring Wernher von Braun. Remember, this is the 1950s before NASA got started, mid-1950s, about space travel, about landing on the moon, about launching, creating a space station, about a trip to Mars, about what life would be like when you got into space. And the other day, I actually went back and watched some of them, and they were just fascinating to watch because, A, white people look different. I mean, you look at Walt Disney, you look at the shots of Walt Disney, Walt Disneyland in Anaheim, and it's just the nostalgia that you have for as you watch the monorail and all these just well-dressed people. I mean, you're talking the 1950s when people would wear suits and women wear dresses, and people look just so civilized when they're going to a theme park, and now people can't even be bothered to wear anything beyond pajamas to go to an airport. I mean, we take for granted of our technological achievements have basically blinded us to our civilizational standards of we really are a prole nation. Who was the guy who wrote that great book? Robert Fussell? Is that the guy
Fussell,
who wrote that book?
Class.
Yeah. Class. That's right. That's right. There's a book that every all your readers and listeners should
I've been meaning to write a review of that for a long, long time. I need to pull it off the shelf.
Procure that book and read it, because when you look back at what we've lost, what we gave up, I mean, it's not cheap on Amazon. You're talking about they only made so many of this because it's from the Disney vault back in the mid-2000s. But it's so worth getting because Von Braun, through these infomercials on ABC, these science factual infomercials, what captivated the nation. Remember, at the same time, you know, Disney was putting out the Davy Crockett TV show, where all the boys they would buy the coonskin hat, they'd get the rifle, and at the same time they put out this amazing documentary. And when you think about Toy Story, which John Lasseter and Brad Bird, Andrew Stanton, Pixar, they came out with, Toy Story is supposed. I've read that it's supposed to kind of take place in like the 1960s. In a weird 1960s when the astronaut has eclipsed the cowboy in terms of popularity, in terms of the vision for the future of what's going to captivate young males to want to buy, to want to then emulate and aspire to be. I don't want to be a cowboy, you know, holding up the concept of law and order. I want to be an astronaut, you know, traversing the stars and colonizing and having these exotic adventures. That's the whole guy, Pixar guys are all about, and they're kind of stuck. And that's why when you watch the Pixar films, they're kind of stuck in this 1960s mentality.
Right.
When the ravages of diversity, they haven't hit these films yet. And when you go back and watch the Tomorrowland with Wernher von Braun, you realize, my God, Walt Disney played a pivotal role in popularizing the our adventures into space. And, you know, he died in his 60s. It is kind of sad to think about how he died, I think, at 56, 57, where, you know, if you had had someone like him live another decade or two, he might have been able to help out a lot more than he did. He was a great man, and I think your site has done some good articles on Disney and sort of some of the myths and around him. But the mere fact that he gave Von Braun a platform to then go out and become a public relations specialist in a lot of ways for these adventures into space before Sputnik was even launched. They were doing these. And Sputnik was launched in 57. And, you know, as we're talking about this timeline, Katherine Johnson is already employed by NACA. She was 1953. And the whole idea about the type of movie that I would do would be I would start out if I had the opportunity to make a movie that was pure propaganda. It would start out in 1969, and it would be set on July 16th, 1969, when you have the who's who of Washington, the who's who of NASA, the who's who of corporate America converge on Cape Canaveral, and they're about to watch the Saturn V launch, and then you have a mule-drawn cart pull up.
Right.
You've got Ralph Abernathy show up with about 300 blacks protesting the moon launch because it was a waste of they basically said that we should be spending money to stop people, to stop black people from being bit by rats and the ghettos of Harlem and Detroit and Chicago and Washington, D.C. And there's this really shocking moment when Thomas Paine, who was the administrator of NASA, kind of the aptly named Thomas Paine in a lot of ways, he goes out and meets with Abernathy, and they actually have this sign that they put around his neck, a placard, and I'm almost embarrassed to read what it says, but the sign read, "I helped hang poverty." So basically at a moment when this technological marvel, this Saturn V rocket, which is, it's frightening to think when you look at this towering into the sky, what this is about to do. It's about to launch three men into space. And Robert Heinlein said that we should start the, you know, we should no longer be, you know, living in AD. We should start over, you know, and year one should be 1969. Because this is the start of a new era. But of course, he was wrong, because we basically gave up and we decided to spend trillions upon trillions of untold dollars to prove that race is a social construct.
Right. We've spent $22 trillion on the war on poverty.
Yeah, 80 welfare programs, that's right.
In inflation-adjusted dollars, $22 trillion. And we have not significantly changed poverty. And we have certainly not changed the racial disparities in crime and poverty and achievements and lack of achievements. It hasn't changed at all. Yet, if we had spent $22 trillion on space and space technology, we really would have flying cars, right? Matt Parrott said something that cracked me up years ago. He said, the future isn't flying cars, it's flaming cars. This was when they were rioting outside of Paris and burning cars. Well, they're doing that again. But yeah, we've lost the flying car future, and we've embraced the flaming car future, the third worldization and decline of the first world. We had this bright future, and it's been taken away from us and replaced with dystopia. One of the things that was so exciting for me about the election of Donald Trump was the fact that Peter Thiel went and gave a speech at the Republican National Convention, and he also gave another speech at the National Press Club, basically saying, look, we've lost our national priorities. We used to be a high-tech country. The whole country was high-tech. The whole country was optimistic. And we have wasted that impetus that put man on the moon. Well, he didn't talk about equalization programs because, well, that's probably a little un-PC, definitely un-PC, but he did talk about trillions of dollars wasted on wars in the Middle East, which is another huge boondoggle. We have to get our priorities straight because, you know, and bringing it back to Interstellar, what's going on in Interstellar? Well, there's a blight that's destroying the Earth, and mankind is regressing. And the only way to get out of this is to go out into space, is to progress, is to innovate. And yet we've gone the opposite direction in that movie, where they've actually argued that the moon landing was a myth, right? They don't want to make people feel bad about the decline of society, so they just lie. It's very much like the lies in Hidden Figures when you get right down to it. It's politic lying rather than truth. And we have to break out of that, as we did in Interstellar, if we're going to survive. There are a lot of Malthusian and environmental traps that are facing us in the future. And we're not going to get out of them by basically spending money on welfare programs that don't actually work. We've got to get out of this by having, instead of 80 different welfare programs at the cost of $22 trillion, we have to have 80 different Manhattan projects and NASAs and spend as many trillions as we need to innovate our way out of these Malthusian and environmental disasters that are awaiting us. Life on Earth really is at stake, and we're just fiddling while Rome burns. And this movie is just a kind of encapsulation of all of the lies and fiddling around that's going on. We're teetering on a razor's edge, right?
Yeah.
We have a very, very narrow, perilous path ahead of us. And if we fall off, that's it.
Interstellar is so fascinating because you don't quite know what catastrophe befell mankind to destroy the First World Society. You get the impression that there was some sort of environmental collapse and that New York is uninhabitable because of the polar ice cap melt. But when you actually kind of understand the joke in the film about Matthew Damon's character, when he's named aptly Dr. Man, of course, that is the same guy who fabricated a lot of the global warming science, as Mark Stein pointed out. When you actually look at the film and you read the script, what's happened, there's a really kind of frightening throwaway line where they talk about how NASA was instructed to drop bombs on India because of a food shortage. If you go back and watch it, you realize that it's the Malthusian nightmare that has transpired, where the arithmetic growth of food production has finally caught up, has finally run into the reality of geometric human population growth. And the movie is basically about a world where there's been a cataclysmic population reduction because of this concept, this idea that everyone deserved a first world lifestyle, and that just wasn't possible or plausible. And that is the reality of what has happened with that Heritage Foundation study that you're quoting, $22 trillion on 80 welfare programs. We basically did give up the stars to try and prove that race is a social construct. And going back to what the black press was talking about, this takes us back to the very beginning. So, you know, I guess this is apropos because of the trajectory of our conversation and the fact that Katherine Johnson was supposed to, you know, formulate your trajectories of the Mercury and Apollo missions. You know, the black press at the time, the article that really pissed off people, you know, the New York Times attacked Paul Kersey because he's been one of the few people to actually point out that this is ridiculous. This is not true. No one really is capable of even formulating a contrarian thought to this belief that this Google Doodle film. I think that's the best way to describe Hidden Figures. It's a Google Doodle on film.
That's great. I love that.
I think that's it. I think that's what it is. And no one has the balls to say, you know, what? Stop for a second. Let's go back and let's look at what the black press was saying. And this was the article that that got some amazing comments over at Ron Unz's website when they ran the piece that went to VDare, because, you know, this has been the thing that goes back to that right after I saw Interstellar. I was just Googling and I found that guy's thesis that he wrote about what the black press said. And when you actually read about the things the black press was saying about how this was a misguided endeavor, this was white people going to the moon, why, you know, black people's sisters are being bit by rats. To me, I found this great quote, and this is in a book. It's called Welcome to the Dream House, Popular Media and Post-War Suburbs by Lynn Spiegel, you know, parentheses, Spiegel, and parentheses. But she's quoting from all the black press at the time, and this was the one that really blew me away. The Chicago Defender, the editor and publisher, his name is John H. Sinekstak. You know, people were initially they were excited about the moon endeavor, but he wrote right after the successful landing on the moon on July 20th, 1969. He wrote in an editorial titled "Lily White NASA." And he said that after the failure to train more black men as astronauts since the death of Major Robert H. Lawrence in 1967, he died during a training exercise. He said that the Pentagon has seen to it that no other black man is selected for that training. In truth, there are virtually no Negroes involved in the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. This is typical American racism in action. Like all other areas of racial bias in American life, which had to be assaulted by picketing and militant demonstrations, NASA awaits its baptism of racial fire before it integrates its space program. Unquote. Now, think about what he just says there. If Katherine Johnson had actually been such an important point, such an important figure in NASA, why wouldn't they have put her out there to say, hey, dude, you know, you have a pretty big readership. You've got the ear of the black community in Chicago, you know, people in Los Angeles, the black community in Los Angeles, in New York. They're writing the same type of editorials. We've got a public relations coup here named Katherine Johnson. we're going to show her and make her available to you to tell your readers, to tell your black readers, because she's a black person too, why this is so important, you know, why we should invest in the future, because it'll help make all our lives with the innovations, make all our lives easier and improve all of our lives with the technology, the technological advances, the job opportunities that are an outgrowth of state of taxpayer funding of these state endeavors. But the exact opposite happens. We actually did do what this guy Cynic Stacky, however you pronounce his name, what he said. I mean, when you actually get down to it, what contributions have blacks made to America other than picketing white achievements because they were not part of them and they wanted to have some access to the loot and to the positions of power that that picketing would allow them to have, or militant demonstrations. You know, isn't that all we see? I mean, think about what's happened at the end of the Obama administration with the continued demonstrations for Michael Brown as being some victim of this oppressive racial justice system. Look at the number one film on Netflix right now. I think it's called 13. It's by the director of Selma, and it's supposedly about how it's a movieization of the book The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, about how, you know, the judicial system is slavery now or something. I don't even know what it's about. It's like, guys, stop it. You know, with that, if these people were roaming around your communities, the, you know, the non-fatal shooting and homicide rate would be double what it is today. I mean, what is it you want us to do? I mean, that's what this whole era, Greg, is all about. You know, we had an opportunity to go to the stars and we put it on hold so that we could go from flying cars to burning cars. What we just see in Sweden now, right, when Donald Trump makes a joke, yeah, or he says something about how, look what's happening in Sweden. What happens 3 days later in one of the suburbs of Stockholm?
Right.
Refugees burn a bunch of cars, just like what's happening in Paris. I mean, it is absolutely insane what has happened, because it is the Western world, the white Western world, tried to prove that race is a social construct. And yet the empirical evidence from this, from the implementation of the scientific method, our conclusions are, oh my God, the racists were right.
Yeah, yeah.
isn't that what 2017, all of the data that we have, we might have spent quadrillions. Who knows the exact number?
Gazillion.
Not just on welfare programs. Yeah, it's the end conclusion is, oh my God, OMG.
I want to end on a note of some savage irony, because I'm in a savage mood. There's the famous poem by Langston Hughes, Harvard. Or no, I'm sorry, not Harvard. Ha ha. Harlem. What am I saying? Harlem by Langston Hughes. What happens to a dream deferred? Well, we have deferred our dream of going into space for decades now. Whitey hasn't been on the moon since 1974. We have spent trillions of dollars on equalizing the unequalizable, on bringing democracy to the Middle East, on nation building on the sands of Arabia, where nothing solid can be founded. And we have deferred our own dream and our own destiny long enough. So let's get back to space. Let's no longer have that dream be a dream deferred.
I think that's a correct way to end it. The door was beginning to crack open. You look at the science fiction writers from Jules Verne to H.G. Wells, all these guys who were popularizing this concept of what could be, this futurist. It was optimistic. It wasn't this dystopian future that so many of our writers now force readers to languish in. We were on the verge of kicking open the door to the heavens. You know, if there's one person I would have always wanted to be able to trade spaces with, places with just for one moment, that would be Neil Armstrong, when he gets off and he puts this foot down for the first time and he kind of looks back at Earth. And at the same time, on August 5th, you've got newspapers with mass audiences editorializing that because blacks feel left out, because white reformers, the social justice warriors of the day, feel that their concerns aren't being met. we had to give up the stars.